This is Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards Tiekert. Not at KPFA, but doing climate coverage in New York. This time I am outside the United Nations, where I've been chasing somewhat important people through side events. In a couple of minutes, we're going to debrief what happened and mostly what did not happen at the United Nations High-Level Climate Summit. But before we do that, there is a very basic theme to all of those conversations, and that is that most of the world is not going to move much on climate policy if the United States, the largest historic polluter in the world, does not move at all. So I wanted to start today with someone who tried to move U.S. politics on climate, who did that by running a presidential campaign with climate policy as its singular focus. Here is my conversation with Washington Governor Jay Inslee, who has bowed out of the Democratic primary. What do you think you accomplished?
Well, I think that we joined thousands of people around the country that has inspired everyone to raise their ambitions and their energies and their standards on defeating climate change. And I think during the course of our campaign, we forced that discussion. I think it was a major reason why we've had forums from major media outlets. I think it's a reason that multiple candidates have now proposed new programs, which they did not when they started their campaigns.
As a side note, this is not just happening in U.S. politics. For example, in the U.K., the Labour Party has just voted to adopt a goal of zeroing out greenhouse gas emissions by the year 2030. Which is very aggressive. The same day, Canada's ruling Liberal Party also released a much more aggressive climate platform. And that was partly because polls showed that the Liberals were losing support to that country's Green Party going into elections precisely because of the public's rising concern about climate change.
So I think a lot happened, but my campaign was not the only reason for that. The upswelling of the youthful voices in the Sunrise Movement, in the climate strikers, this has really moved the debate on their speaking on the moral high ground. So it's been a team effort, and I'm very pleased that we have raised both the temperature of this debate and the standards of performance. I'm particularly pleased I've seen, Senator Warren has really embraced the standards of concrete assurance of decarbonizing the economy that I had proposed. Other candidates have other vestiges of that.
What do you see as the most important policy divisions in the party over how to address climate change?
I think the clearest one is in the need for clear, concrete requirements for removing ourselves from the usage of fossil fuels in major portions. We have proposed to do that. We've now seen Senator Warren adopt those in her standards. I think those are the things that are the most, frankly, critical part of an eventually successful policy. But I'm looking forward to that debate continues. Good luck.
That's mostly a dig at Joe Biden, who does not have specific emissions goals that are set sooner than the year 2050. This, it goes without saying, is very long after the political career of Joe Biden will be over. All right, on to the United Nations. I wanted to debrief Monday's high-level talks, which I played you excerpts from yesterday. This is when countries were supposed to announce more aggressive goals for cutting greenhouse gas pollution. But when I asked Catherine Abreu, the executive director of the Climate Action Network Canada, what the biggest development was, she didn't even bring up anything that happened inside the United Nations.
To be totally honest, I actually think that the most significant thing that's come out of this is the incredible mobilization that we've seen from young people and hundreds of thousands of citizens around the globe who've joined them. That's what I'm feeling most inspired and impressed by. When it comes to the commitments made by leaders, whether government leaders or private sector leaders in the context of the Climate Action Summit, there are a couple of things of note, but overall, it has been my impression that they more than ever are conscious of the need to respond to the demands for climate action coming from young people and these hundreds of thousands of mobilized citizens around the world, but they actually have no practice in mustering the level of conviction that this challenge requires.
Concretely, like, the point of the Climate Action Summit was to get countries to announce that they're doing more than they'd previously committed to stop emitting greenhouse gases. Did anything significant come out on that front?
So a couple of countries definitely stepped up to the plate and talked about how they're going to increase their ambition. We also had several...
Like who?
So we saw, a number of countries like Greece talk about moving away from coal-fired electricity. We saw 65 countries join the Net Zero Coalition, which pledges them to get to net zero emissions by 2050, including the EU. Actually, 105 cities also joined that coalition, and we saw announcements to dramatically reduce emissions from cities like Montreal and my home country of Canada, that pledged to reduce emissions 55% by 2030 and get to that net zero by 2050. We also saw a lot of the countries most vulnerable to the impacts of climate change, like small island developing states, commit to achieving 100% renewable energy with assistance. So that means they're going to need financial help to get to that commitment.
But, like, practically speaking, if the Marshall Islands, population 51,000, commits to getting to, you know, zero net emissions, that doesn't really change the state of the climate. It's just a bid to shame larger countries into following their lead.
Yeah, so I think 2 points maybe on that. The first, the kind of moral leadership that we see from these smaller, most vulnerable countries is beautiful and important, but you're right, it's not going to get us there in terms of the emissions reductions that we require. It was amazing to hear the representative from Barbados say, you know, had addressing this global crisis been totally up to us, it would have been solved 30 years ago. And there she was pointing to the need for the world's wealthiest industrialized nations to step up to the plate. And they were really mostly missing from this summit.
So nothing new from China, the world's largest emitter.
Exactly.
The United States, basically a non-presence.
Non-presence. President Trump showed up for 15 minutes of the conference.
And sat in the audience.
Sat in the audience, and I hear politely clapped for Prime Minister Modi.
Prime Minister Modi from India, representing one of the top polluters and the one whose pollution curb, the amount they're emitting per year, is going up the fastest. He proposed to build more renewable energy capacity, but that doesn't mean they're going to be actually cutting pollution, does it?
It does not necessarily mean that, although we have seen that in India and China, as more renewable energy comes online, the coal plants that are proposed are being taken off the books. So, you know, while we did not get that commitment, I think we can extrapolate that that will result in fewer coal plants being built and ideally no coal plants being built. But yeah, you're totally right. Nothing incredibly motivating or moving coming from some of the world's largest polluters. And I think it's important to talk about countries like China and India, but necessary for us to keep in mind that those countries are not historically responsible for this crisis. It is the industrialized nations that also have far greater financial resources at their disposal that bear that historic responsibility. And so while we can point to the fact that China made no new commitments yesterday as a real missed opportunity on their part, I'm far more concerned with the fact that we didn't hear anything from really rich countries like the United States about how they're going to be contributing to solving this problem.
Counterfactual, like if the United States had come to this summit and said, we're doing X, Y, and Z to cut pollution much more aggressively than we had promised to in the past, do you think you would have seen matching commitments from China?
Potentially. We've definitely seen that kind of dynamic emerge between the U.S. and China in the past. We saw that China-U.S. Climate Action Pact signed between Xi and Obama in 2015. And that kind of cooperation, I think, is very useful. But in the end, I guess I just have a question around whether a summit like this is the right kind of vehicle to drive the ambition that we need anymore. So we've become quite used to summits on climate action in the last number of years, and they have been instrumental, I think, in building the narrative for the need of enhanced climate action. But at this point, we are in the implementation phase of the Paris Agreement. We're in the phase where we need to be getting into the nitty-gritty and figuring out how to get this done, how to muster, as I said, that level of conviction that is required. And really what that means is shaking away the status quo economy that really relies on our fossil fuel addiction and status quo politics that kowtows to the interests of the fossil fuel industry. And we haven't seen leaders ready to break free from that to the extent that we need to yet.
I guess the big question I'm getting at is 4 million people in the streets on Friday, biggest coordinated climate action in the history of the world. Did it move the needle at all inside the United Nations?
Yeah, I think it did move the needle in terms of the recognition by people that they need to do something. But they don't have the... So what I've been saying is that this kind of work is a muscle. And those government and private sector leaders that I think at this point, because of the mobilization that we're seeing, understand that they have to say something about how they're going to respond to this question, are really out of shape. They don't have those muscles that they can flex to respond in the meaningful way that they need to be responding to the demands from the street. So I think we've seen the needle move in terms of public awareness, in terms of the kind of social proof that there is a large constituency in countries around the world who care about climate action and are going to demand that from their leaders. I think we've seen that leaders acknowledge that that's what's being demanded of them, but they still have to figure out how to respond to those demands.
So you said a couple of minutes ago, you're just kind of giving up on UN summits as a platform for meaningful climate action. And at this point, they do feel really performative. I guess the question is, what's the alternative, right? It's a global problem. Addressing it requires collective action by nations that have no uber government tying them together. So if not the United Nations, then what?
Yeah, it definitely doesn't mean that things like the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change goes away, or the conferences of parties to the Paris Agreement, those annual UN meetings, go away. I think those still serve a really necessary purpose to get countries together, share lessons learned about climate action, and articulate those points where collective efforts are really needed. But at this point, we need to be digging down at the domestic level, thinking about how we're going to transform our economies so that they are aligned with climate protection, are protecting workers and communities, and are protecting those communities most vulnerable to climate impacts that are also generally on the front lines of climate solutions, like indigenous peoples, communities of color, communities that are on the coast or in the far north. It's at that very local level that we need to be thinking right now for global impact, yes, of course, and international multilateral clubs like the Powering Past Coal Alliance have a role to play in climate diplomacy that kind of encourages countries like Japan to stop investing so much in coal, or we saw Germany actually join the Powering Past Coal Alliance in the last few days. A country that is often thought of as a climate leader has been encouraged by this multilateral club to get rid of that kind of one final thing that was holding them back from true climate leadership.
Again, that was Catherine Abreu. She is the Executive Director of Climate Action Network Canada. Now, the final thing I want to do is follow up on the segment we aired yesterday on oil drilling and fracking in California, and specifically why Governor Gavin Newsom really hedges his answers every time he gets asked about them which is pretty much every time he appears at a climate-related forum here in New York. I want to kind of get into the question of what's been going on at California's Division of Oil, Gas, and Geothermal Resources, the agency called Dogger, after a newspaper investigation found what looked like some funny business. I chased down the person in the chain of command who sits directly above that agency and directly below Governor Newsom. This is California Secretary of Natural Resources, Wade Crowfoot. Basically, like a big mess blew up this summer. The Palm Springs Desert Sun found there had been a dramatic escalation in the number of extraction permits going out the door, fracking-like permits going out the door, and there were at least eight agency staff who owned stock in oil companies. Can you kind of walk me through what you've been doing as the person directly overseeing that agency since then?
Yeah, absolutely. So Gavin Newsom, as our governor, has made clear a couple of things. First is there is a zero tolerance policy for anything that is not fair, aggressive regulatory oversight over fossil fuels. So where there has been irregularities, allegations made as it relates to permitting, oversight, we are thoroughly reviewing all of those. And that's in process. And of course, we'll share the results of all of those inquiries over time. But be clear, we want to ensure that there is fair, and I think the governor has basically said, strengthened regulatory oversight over the oil and gas industry. Secondly, the governor, I think we've made clear that, you know, our future is a low carbon and no carbon economy. So we are focused on ultimately transitioning our economy to reduce and ultimately remove our reliance on fossil fuels. And so that means charting a long-term pathway to manage the decline of oil and gas supply as our demand for oil and gas is reduced in California.
Is the agency actually set up to manage that? It's like a 100-year-old agency that was set up before environmental regulation was something government did.
Yeah, the agency needs to evolve and align with California's ultimate decarbonization strategy. That much is clear. Legislation passed earlier this month that actually evolves the mission of that division and actually has it focus on actually managing energy versus treating oil and gas as a resource. And that's important. At the same time, there has to be a lot more focus on that division, which is overseeing oil and gas extraction, working with other entities within state government, like the Air Resources Board, that are charting that long-term pathway. We're very excited that the governor and the legislature have passed funding for a study that the University of California will be completing to really identify the pathway towards how we manage the decline of supply of oil and gas as we reduce our dependence on it.
You keep talking about managing decline. I guess like the basic question is, why issue any new permits for drilling for oil or gas or extracting oil or gas at all? I mean, why not just hit the brakes now?
Yeah, well, I would say a couple things. First of all, California's supply of oil has been on the decline for some time. Oil is getting harder and harder to extract in California. Secondly, the governor, you know, has been clear that we need to manage this transition in an ambitious way, but a thoughtful way as well. Certainly, many Californians are driving cars that require gasoline. We import about two-thirds of our gasoline and produce about a third of oil for gas in the state. The most important thing, you know, we need to do to drive down the desire for supply is reducing demand and not just replacing what is oil produced in California with oil imported from Saudi Arabia or other places. But at the same time, I think the governor's made it clear that we can do more than we have to really think about how we proactively manage the supply. I'll say that parts of the state that rely on oil and gas for jobs, specifically Kern County, as the governor's identified, we need to make sure we're not leaving those men and women behind as well. So this is known as the so-called just transition to clean energy. How do we transition in a way that doesn't leave people behind that have depended on that industry for their jobs? another appropriation in the legislature of $35 million is focused on helping with that jobs transition as well. So I think it's clear that we want to move forward ambitiously and in an unprecedented manner, but also thoughtfully.
But those wells aren't just, you know, keeping people's cars moving. They're polluting aquifers. They're polluting the air, particularly in Kern County. They're threatening California's water supplies. We're a state without a lot of extra water. I guess California has wells that have been producing for decades are going to keep producing. But like, what's the rationale for approving even one new well?
Well, I think we've been clear, again, really two primary priorities. Is one is set us on a pathway to reduce our dependence and concurrently reduce our supply. And then second is to ensure that any extraction that takes place, existing well, et cetera, is done in a way that protects human health and safety and minimizes any environmental impact. And I would say we all have work to do to ensure a future that in which there's far less demand for this. Right now we have 626,000 electric vehicles in California. I often tell my friends one important way they can vote for a fossil-free future is to actually go out and buy one of those 47 models of electric vehicles to reducing demand. But we need to do both, obviously. Proactively and ambitiously reduce demand, but then also think about how we reduce that supply as demand goes down.
Secretary Crowfoot, thank you very much.
Yes, thank you.
Again, that's Wade Crowfoot. He is California's Secretary of Natural Resources. That puts him in charge of, among other things, the state's very troubled Division of Oil, Gas, and Geothermal Resources, which is the branch of state government that hands out permits for oil drilling and enhanced extraction techniques like fracking. Tomorrow, we're going to shift focus back to the young activists who helped organize last week's mass climate strike here in New York. And we're going to check in on how they feel about seeing the United Nations respond with not much. We're also going to take a look at what other avenues for climate action exist. So tune in for that. Let's go out with the voice of one more youth delegate who got a so-called green ticket to attend the United Nations proceedings.
Okay, my name is Safin Dash. I'm from Guyana.
So tell me how climate change is impacting Guyana.
Okay, so Guyana is actually in a very unique situation. We are part of the small island developing states. We're not an island, but we are one of the few countries that hardly emit about 0.00% of the carbon emissions in the world due to the mere fact 80% of our country is Amazonian forests. But when it comes to climate change impacting us, 90% of our population lives on the coast of our country, and the coast is below sea level. So as sea level rises, we have such as storm surges, flash floods, spring tides, causing millions in damages to households. We also have a rich amount of indigenous people who live in our interior, and our interior suffers from devastating droughts, and climate change actually caused 2 years ago to have such a long drought that it killed persons. Cattle rearing is one of the main economic activities going on in the interior, and it caused the death of cattle. It caused persons to lose their source of income. Our country is one where 40% of it, 40% of our GDP is attributed to agricultural practices. And climate change actually changes the patterns we know in Guyana. Like we know, May, June, we have wet season. November, December, we have wet season. August to September to October is dry season. But this August, rain poured. And that actually affected our farmers a lot. They even had a chicken shortage due to rain pouring too much, and they couldn't tend to the chicken. So people are going to KFC, like, why there's no chicken? But it's the mere fact that climate change caused them to not be able to actually monitor and actually plan out how they're going to do what they do, because they plant around the weather. Planting crops, certain crops can't take a lot of water. And they plant it because they're thinking August, well, sun is going to shine. And it really affects our farmers. And that is 40% of the country's GDP. That can actually cripple our nation. Guyana is in a very unique situation, and next year we're actually going to have the first oil. We're actually two companies are actually drilling for oil on our shores, and So we all know we have to balance it with, we're always the persons who are carbon sinks, but now we'll be carbon emitters. And so we're on a forefront where youths have to say something, because at the end of the day, we make up 50% of our population. Our economy, our population is a young, growing population, and we'll be the ones that have to balance the oil exploration and the environment.
You talked about balancing the oil exploration, but can you afford any at all?
So our earnings are supposed to be invested into renewable energy, such as solar, wind and water, where it is feasible in the country. And it is supposed to be used to create commissions and to educate persons and to offer scholarships for green jobs. So we're supposed to use those funds to actually be able to balance it. We're supposed to do that. That is what is stated. Mine, I'm saying supposed to.
I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert. I am not at KPFA. I'm in New York covering the United Nations, climate change, and assorted climate actions outside the confines of the United Nations. Back to you, Kat.